Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Alice Bryant and Susan Shand. Pete Musto brings us this week's science report, and Kelly Jean Kelly presents our next episode of America's Presidents. This week, we talk about Barack Obama, the 44th President of the United States. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
More than a year after Hurricane Maria, the government of Puerto Rico remains unprepared for future natural disasters. Officials there recently admitted that they have not made a new disaster plan. And it is not clear when they will, the Associated Press reports. For months, the government of the U.S. territory said it had completed a disaster plan. It said the plan was being kept secret to protect information about weak infrastructure as well as the private contact details of officials. But Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism recently took legal action to get the government to release the plan. That is what led officials to admit that its plan does not deal with major disaster events like hurricanes and earthquakes. Many Puerto Ricans are angry. They blame the government for the nearly 3,000 deaths linked to Hurricane Maria, a Category 4 storm that hit the island in September 2017. Nazario Lugo is a former director of Puerto Rico's Emergency Management Agency and president of the island's Association of Emergency Managers. He told the AP, "The government has clearly failed the people and hid the fact that the plan was under revision." Carlos Acevedo is director of Puerto Rico's Bureau for Emergency and Disaster Management. He did not answer the AP's requests for comment about why the plan has not been completed. Government lawyer Tanya Fernandez said last month that she did not know when the plan would be finished and made public. She said officials have not yet hired experts to create such plans. A partial plan that the government released last month notes the dangers of poor preparation. The document said the effects of Hurricane Maria made it clear that the government did not have a plan or enough resources to deal with such a large storm. However, Lugo and another former Emergency Management Agency director, Epifanio Jimenez, said Puerto Rico does have a plan for a Category 4 hurricane. They said it was created in 1989 after the Category 3 Hurricane Hugo hit the island. But, they say, Governor Ricardo Rosello's administration failed to follow it when Maria hit. Lugo and Jimenez said a lack of fuel and truck drivers, poor communication between local governments, and a slow delivery of supplies made carrying out the emergency plan after Maria more difficult. They said officials also did not know the immediate needs of each area on the island. Jesus Cuartas is an operational planning chief for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. He said that even though Puerto Rico has not finished an official plan, local and federal officials have learned lessons from Maria. He believes Puerto Rico is more prepared now than when the storm hit. Cuartas urged patience, adding that a rushed plan would not be an effective one. I'm Alice Bryant.
Baggio Leung is the new spokesman for the pro-independence party Hong Kong National Front. Recently, he spoke about the need for political change in Hong Kong. Independence is the only way for Hong Kong to survive, he said. Without a democratic system, we can never end the privileged class ruling in Hong Kong, he added. He keeps his voice low, possibly because a lot of what he says could make the police consider him a threat to the state. The government of Hong Kong has ruled that his ideas are unconstitutional. Leung is the latest young politician to call for Hong Kong's independence from China. He says it is a necessary first step for democratic reform. He believes there can be no change without separation from China. He is not the only young person to feel this way. Hong Kong National Front and a few other groups of mostly young people continue to call for independence or a referendum on the subject. Many of their political ideas developed from political events that have taken place in Hong Kong since democracy protests known as the Umbrella Movement in 2014. Some young people tried to enter politics to cause change, but they found they were blocked. Leung was elected to the city's Legislative Council in 2016, but he was barred from office with five other pro-democracy politicians for changing his oath of office as a political protest. Since then, other pro-democracy candidates like Agnes Chow and Lau Siu Lai have been barred from running for public office. They support ideas like self-determination. In addition, the leaders of the Umbrella Movement have been put on trial. In September, the city banned the Hong Kong National Party. Officials said it was a threat to national security for its pro-independence ideas. Many in Hong Kong believe China's Communist Party was behind the ban. They also believe the city's self-rule is under threat. When Britain handed over the former colony to China in 1997, the Chinese government promised Hong Kong self-rule until 2047. The Hong Kong National Front reaches out into the community, said Leung. Other groups like the pro-independence Student Localism and Student Independence Union are doing similar things with high school and university students. Online, discussion of independence continues on Cantonese internet websites like hkgolden.com and lihkg.com. Most of the students want freedom, but they don't know how to express their view of freedom, said Wayne Chan. He founded the Student Independence Union in January. He said many students do not support independence, but would like to see a referendum on Hong Kong's future. The Student Independence Union is pushing for such a referendum. The group also wants the United States government to sign the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. The act would place penalties on anyone found responsible for interfering with a Hong Konger's right to free speech or association. Benny Tai is an associate professor at the University of Hong Kong, and he helped start the Umbrella Movement. He said his group will continue its efforts. I think to young people in Hong Kong, independence is a choice that they will still consider now, even though they may not talk about that in the open, he said by email. As people get more and more dissatisfied with the Chinese Communist Party, they will naturally hope for independence, even though they have no idea and no plan on how it will happen. I'm Susan Shand. Looking out the window of his Ford truck, Bob Fitzgerald sees large, undesirable plants growing in the fields. Visitors to his neighborhood in Princess Anne, Maryland, mainly see dying forests and empty farmland. Fitzgerald says the land has been in his family since the 17th century.
I'd say in the next 20 years, you're going to lose a very high percentage of that land that's going to be unfit to farm.
The land around the Chesapeake Bay has been sinking for hundreds of years. But climate change is making things worse. As sea levels rise, salt water is entering rivers and other waterways. As a result, the ground is becoming too salty for crops to grow. Maryland's eastern shore is home to some of the oldest farms in North America. Fitzgerald's dates back to 1666. He says he has seen big changes during his life.
You just can't believe how he's taken things over in the last 15 or 20 years. I can show you land around here that people raised tomatoes on when I was a little boy, and now it's gone.
Around the world, scientists warn that coastal farms are under threat from rising seas and salt water. A World Bank report estimates that rice production in coastal areas of Bangladesh may fall by 15% by the year 2050. Another study found that hundreds of millions of people will be forced to move inland because of rising waters. Kate Tully wants to keep Eastern Shore farmers in business as the seas rise. Tully is an agroecologist with the University of Maryland. She has seen the forests filled with pine trees killed by the increasingly salty soil. When she started looking at maps, she said, "I realized that a lot of the land was farms." She started talking to farmers and asking if this was an issue on farms. It was, but a lot of people hadn't really been talking about it outside their own communities, she said. The United States Department of Agriculture gave Tully and other researchers $1.1 million to study the problem. She and her team hope to give farmers ways to stay on their land. She told VOA they are testing different crops on pieces of land around the Eastern Shore.
Sorghum is my new favorite crop because it can grow without rain and it can grow with lots of rain. So this is actually looks like a pretty good option.
The grain crop may be a good choice to feed the nearly 600 million chickens raised in the area each year. As farmers know, chickens can deal with salt, dry weather conditions, and heavy rains. Tully's group is also testing other kinds of grain and a few crops that they believe can grow in the salt. Yet just being able to grow a crop is not enough. The crop has to be profitable. So an economist on the team will be looking at the numbers. But continuing to farm the land may not be the best plan of action. Some people believe the land should be given back to nature. They say the fields should be turned into wetlands, which are popular with duck hunters. There's money in duck hunting, Tully said. Hunting organizations will pay farmers for a permit to hunt on their land. Farmers could earn a lot of money from duck hunters, she said. Tully and her team are just getting started. It will be a few years before they really understand how to save the farms. They have proposals for what will help communities that have been farming this land for hundreds of years.
There's a lot of history there, and as these seas rise, some of that history is going underwater.
I'm Susan Shand.
A new study says the protective layer of the Earth's atmosphere is finally healing from damage by humans' use of harmful chemicals. Aerosol sprays and coolants had been thinning the ozone layer since the 1970s. After scientists raised concerns about ozone-reducing chemicals, people and companies around the world stopped using them. Ozone is a colorless combination of three oxygen atoms. The ozone layer starts at about 10 kilometers above Earth and stretches nearly 40 kilometers higher. The ozone layer is important because it protects Earth from the sun's ultraviolet rays, which cause skin cancer, crop damage, and other problems. But man-made chemicals, called chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, can damage the ozone layer. In 1987, countries around the world agreed in the Montreal Protocol to end the use of CFCs over time. The United Nations released a study on the effects of the decreased use of CFCs at a conference in Quito, Ecuador, in early November. The study found that the upper ozone layer above the northern hemisphere should be completely repaired in the 2030s. The huge Antarctic ozone hole should disappear in the 2060s. The southern hemisphere should be healed by about the 2050s, the study showed. Paul Newman is the chief Earth scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and co-leader of the study. He told the Associated Press, "The findings are good news. If ozone-depleting substances had continued to increase, we would have seen huge effects," said Newman. "We stopped that. Newman noted that at its worst in the late 1990s, about 10% of the upper ozone layer was depleted. Since 2000, the ozone layer has increased by about 1 to 3% every 10 years, the report said. This year, the ozone hole over the South Pole measured nearly 24.8 million square kilometers in area. That is about 16% smaller than the biggest hole recorded, 29.6 million square kilometers in 2006. The hole reaches its largest size during September and October, when the southern hemisphere has its spring. The hole disappears by late December. If nothing had been done to stop the thinning, the world would have destroyed two-thirds of its ozone layer by 2065, Newman said. But the changes are not a complete success yet, said a University of Colorado atmospheric science professor. Brian Toon, who was not part of the report, pointed to some ozone measurements that have not increased yet. We are only at a point where recovery may have started, said Toon. The report noted another problem. New technology has found that a banned CFC is being used in East Asia. On its own, the ozone hole has slightly helped protect Antarctica from the effects of global warming. Ross Salowich is a University of Maryland atmospheric scientist who helped write the report. He said an undamaged ozone layer would actually trap greenhouse gases that cause global warming. Antarctica has heated up, but not as much as it likely would without the decrease of the ozone layer. Salowich said scientists do not know how much a healed ozone hole will continue to warm Antarctica. But they do know that decreasing the ozone layer would severely damage the world and human health. Not permitting the ozone layer to heal would be incredibly irresponsible, he said. NASA's Paul Newman points to another step humans can take. The chemicals that have replaced CFCs need to be replaced with chemicals that do not worsen global warming. An amendment to the Montreal Protocol that goes into effect next year would cut some of those gases. I don't think we can do a victory lap until 2060, Newman said. That will be for our grandchildren to do. I'm Pete Musto.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Barack Obama. He first took office in 2009 and was re-elected in 2012. Because his presidency is so recent, this program will not try to offer a historical perspective. But one part of his legacy is already clear. Obama is the United States' first African-American president. His father was a black man from Kenya. His mother was a white American from the Midwestern state of Kansas. For many Americans, Obama's presidency was an important symbol in a country that permitted black people to be enslaved. And even after the U.S. Constitution officially banned slavery in 1865, African Americans have been extremely underrepresented in the U.S. government. By 2009, only 5 African Americans had ever served in the U.S. Senate, and Obama was one of them. Even many people who did not vote for Obama said his election to the country's highest office made them proud or hopeful. A public opinion survey immediately after Election Day found that 2/3 of Americans believed that the country's racial conflicts could be resolved. Obama's parents met as students at the University of Hawaii. His father had won a scholarship to study economics. His mother went on to earn a degree in math there, as well as a graduate degree. The two married and had a son, whom they named after his father, Barack Hussein Obama, Jr. But the couple soon separated. The older Barack Obama returned to Kenya, where he later died in a car accident. Barack's mother went on to marry another man. He was from Indonesia. The family moved to Jakarta, and the couple had a daughter named Maya. When Barack was 10, his mother sent him back to Hawaii to live with her parents. She wanted him to get a good education. Barack finished high school in Hawaii, then went on to Occidental College in Los Angeles. After 2 years, he transferred to Columbia University in New York. There, he completed a degree in political science. But Obama said the best education he received was in one of his first jobs. He worked as a community organizer in Chicago. He helped people who lived in public housing put pressure on the city government to improve their conditions. Obama later said the work showed him how important it was to understand the legal process. So he entered Harvard Law School. Over the next years, Obama worked as a lawyer, wrote a book about his experience as a person of mixed race, and married Michelle Robinson, a woman he worked with at a law firm. She and Barack Obama settled in Chicago and had 2 daughters, Malia and Sasha. When he was in his mid-30s, Obama began his political career. He was elected 3 times to the Illinois State Senate. After 10 years there, he won a seat in the U.S. Senate in a landslide victory. That same year, Obama attended the Democratic National Convention, the meeting where the party officially nominates a presidential candidate. Obama was not one of the candidates, but the Democrats asked him to make an important speech. In it, Obama famously talked about how his life story was an American story. He said he was confident the U.S. could overcome its divisions and achieve unity. "There is not a liberal America and a conservative America," he said. "There's not a black America and white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's a United States of America." Only 4 years later, Obama would be elected its 44th president. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for more stories and information from around the world. Thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Thompson.